Great teaching happens when teachers get time to think. Walk into an Educate classroom and you'll find a consistent approach to homework, teachers who know where knowledge gaps are, and students who are doing regular retrieval practice. With Educate, you can be free from marking homework by the end of the week. Students have now answered over 1 billion questions on Educate. If you're looking to set up centralised homework and revision in your geography department, you won't be disappointed. Your first month is free at educate.co.uk/geography.
All right, welcome to the plenary session of this Geographical Association EDI series. So I am joined by four of my colleagues. I'm joined with Sarah, Alice and Akira. So I'm going to let these folks introduce themselves. So Sarah, would you like to go first?
My name is Sarah Hayden and I've been a geography teacher for 16 plus years. And in the last 4 or 5 years, I've retrained as a SENCO. And from that point on, have taken a very active interest in developing teacher practice to ensure that we can maximise the learning opportunities in the classroom and fieldwork to ensure where possible. And I say that with reference to, and actually it's one of the points I hope you'll be talking about later on, with reference to kind of like being fixed by exam boards and results, etc. But try to make practice as inclusive as possible to make sure everyone can succeed with their geography. So that's me.
Fantastic. Akira.
Hi, I'm Akira. I'm an undergraduate geographer and also a student, I'd say student activist, student advocate for more inclusive education. And I've been working on a student educational campaign called Rerouted for about over 3 years now. And I've been co-designing a resource with secondary school teachers on inclusive curriculums that mainly focus on looking at colonial histories within geography and the way that we contextualize case studies and include community voice within our classrooms. So yeah, I've been thinking a lot about race, culture, and class representations and the ways in which those are kind of explored through the language of geography, but also thinking about practically structural changes that need to be made in schools to make geography more inclusive to students like myself, working class students, people of colour, who tend not to go into geography higher education, and thinking about how we can kind of bridge that gap in secondary school education to make the curriculum a little bit more accessible for people from these backgrounds. So yeah, that's me.
I'm always honored to have Akira to come to these kind of things. She is a fantastic, I mean, 3 years, Akira, that's just crazy. I mean, it feels like you've been in our community for a long, long, long time. But, you know, I was just about to say, you're also that fantastic bridge for us between, you know, us as in the profession and the youth voice, the student voice. And so, you know, you are in that unique position. And it's a voice that we need more often and more vocal. So
and we
again,
need
folks,
more as I'm getting older now. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you'll always be younger than me, Akira. Alice.
Hello, I'm Alice Hoy. I'm a secondary geography teacher in South London. I've been researching and looking into inclusivity with the LGBTQ plus community within the geography curriculum through from key stage 3 right up until key stage 5. Kit and I have been working together as well on with the RGS as well, looking at how to bridge the gap, not only between secondary school, but also higher education as well. My main aim is to make the curriculum more inclusive and have more voices and narratives within the classroom and reduce that us and them narrative into our everyday language.
Fantastic. Yeah, so you can see we're trying to represent as many as these communities as possible between us. But as you'll get to hear when we have our discussion, then there is so much overlap as well. And finally, to introduce introduce me very briefly. So my name is Kit Marie and my pronouns are they, she. And I was a high school teacher for 13 years. I taught geography, of course, but I've been a consultant for the GA for quite a while now, 7 or 8 years or so. And I'm an openly trans educator, and I try to utilize these platforms such as this to enhance visibility and, you know, to kind of drive inclusivity just simply by being myself. So many of you have heard this, my stories before, so I'm going to stop right there. I do have some standard things we're going to go through, and we'll kind of like naturally just try and weave our way through this. So the first question I really want to ask, you know, folks, just jump in, interject whenever, and it could be from your personal point of view, your expertise point of view, and, you know, feel free to opine as well. But in each of your views, how do you feel that us geographers can use our inherent interdisciplinary nature, because our subject is, to promote the concept of intersectional teaching and learning? So we'd like to go first on that one. So the fact that we know that geography itself is very intersectional, very interdisciplinary, how can we use that to our advantage?
I would say that geography as a subject, particularly in secondary education, is so lucky, because although we have a curriculum that we need to stick to, there are so many perceptions and voices that can be heard within the classroom. And we can attach own experiences and experiences of other within to not only our case studies, but on top of existing specifications as well. I would say that the fact it is interdisciplinary, we can also use cross-curricular as well and speak to other members of departments. So it's not just voices being heard within the geography classroom, but also voices being heard around the school, which I think is really powerful.
Yep, just come straight in, Sarah. No need for me to prompt.
Brilliant. Okay, so I think the fact that geography, regardless of, you know, which topic or which particular field we're looking at, fundamentally, one of the biggest aspects of geography is the inquiry approach, whether that be out in the field or whether that be in the classroom, and the use of fertile questions, etc. But I do think that there is huge opportunities to look at this kind of universal design for learning and actually focus more on teaching pupils the skills so that they can inquire about anything within a topic, and they can design their own pathways, really. And as teachers, that we can facilitate that by providing resources and also the opportunity to reflect on the skills that they've used to go about that. So, you know, especially where there's freedoms, such as the Key Stage 3 curriculum, where we have a bit more breadth to be able to do that. And I think that that is something that we can, and I think we do anyway, naturally encourage. But it would be exciting to take that even further and, you know, set parameters, but allow pupils to kind of design their own way through, to have their own personal take on things. And one of the kind of, I would say, keystone aspects of designing differentiated lessons, for example, would be, you know, or adaptive, whatever, would be to actually just allow points of reflection quite regularly, and to be able to design opportunities for metacognition and to think critically about how they've gone about finding out information about a particular topic, but also the skills that they've used, what's gone well, what's not gone well, especially when they're working with each other. So I think, you know, that there's huge opportunities, and that could be cross-curricular as well. So that would be sort of where I see potential, even more potential within our subject.
Yeah, you mentioned, and of course, now adaptive teaching is now like one of the main teaching standards now. So it's replaced differentiation.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you're absolutely right. And I had a conversation with a student today, actually, as part of my day job, about his higher education aspirations. And he couldn't decide whether he wanted to do chemistry or computer science at higher education. And so we looked, so I did what I do is just look at, well, where is the overlap? You know, where could the computer science and chemistry? And it's, and almost without exception, every single node of contact was geographical. So, so we have the advantage of playing on that, you know, both in our strategies, like adaptive teaching, differentiation, stuff like that, but also, as you said at the top, Sarah, about where you want our students to head towards, you know, with their direction, with their aspirations and whatnot. What do you think, Akira?
Yeah, I think bouncing off that point, I think at secondary school level, I think sometimes, yeah, the curriculum can be a bit like prescriptive and students often can't tell where they fit within actually geography learning. And I think what you were saying, Sarah, is really true about like that inquiry can come in at any stage of a student's secondary school education. Like it doesn't have to arrive at GCSE. Like you can encourage students to use geographical skills to ask questions of their own communities and themselves and the things they're observing in the world. From year seven, and it starts to familiarize students with the fact that actual geographical tools are useful in understanding their own worlds, not just the worlds of like these very set topics that you find in the curriculum. So I do think that there's a lot of room for that inquiry and that overlap of different topics that students might be interested in to actually converge in geography, and they just need prompting to really see how that can happen.
Take an inquiry approach. God, love it. That's the best, one of the best things about geography. I'm actually going to go straight on to a question that was actually posed, I think it was in your session, Akira, and see what we all think on this, because it stems quite nicely about what we've all just been saying. And there was somebody who asked you in I think it was your Aniram session about, and they, I'll just read it almost verbatim. They said, do you have any tips to balance between the desire to decolonize, make lessons anti-racist or inclusive in any way, shape or form, versus the need for students to know particular content to get marks, you know, particularly at Key Stage 4? Now, we did give an answer to this person via, you know, after the session, we wrote them a text and it went and whatnot. But yeah, I don't want to steal anyone's thunder, but Akira, do you want to start with that one? Should we be balancing the whole need to decolonize versus the content curriculum?
I mean, I think that was also kind of brought up in part of the question, thinking about textbooks and the resources actually that we use to teach things that are on the curriculum. And it really isn't about necessarily choosing between the two, thinking about your curriculum or like making your teaching inclusive, but it's about maybe your source materials and how intersectional and inclusive your source materials are. If you're using textbooks that aren't thinking critically around the different case studies, for instance, that you're presenting and thinking about, actually, there are multiple and plural perspectives that can be brought out of this case study, then you're going to think that they're mutually exclusive, having an inclusive lesson and meeting the requirements of your exam board.
Alice or Sarah, do you have any thoughts about, I mean, the two words that we gave, the answer that we gave last time, the two words were, they are not mutually exclusive, basically. You should be able to teach the curriculum in a decolonial way. But do you have any further thoughts, Alice or Sarah?
I can go. So I do think that teachers, it's just recognizing that it is really tricky because of the pressure that teachers are on, depending on, again, this is where in my session where I talked about having a really close look at the way your school's set up, I think is really important. And looking at your SLT and thinking about how the school is driving that and what therefore you can take from that and pull in terms of the way you're teaching those lessons, because some schools have a really strict structure on how a single lesson will operate. You know, there has to be a certain percentage of time given to reading, in which case, you know, is there support and budget to be able to take the time to go and design what pupils are reading? And, you know, is there a working group within the school that is, you know, putting aside time to do that? The other thing is also, I suppose, just as a kind of a way of doing it, would be, again, to think about these critical reflection points, because I think actually developing questioning skills within pupils is really valuable. So, you know, a lesson could be taught and actually then let's hear from them about various different things, maybe designing some questions, you know, or reflection points, and then bringing that back as a class can also be a way of doing this, I think, and hearing the voices of the pupils and getting them engaged and involved in not just the design of the curriculum, but also in sort of just discussing how things have been taught and how things are presented, I think. So the curriculum is taught, but the reflection points are built in. But again, you know, even down to how many lessons are being taught within a week for the subjects is quite different in different parts of the country. So some might have 2 40-minute sessions, some might have 1 hour, some might have, you know, different timetables on different, you know, there's so many different ways that, but having you know, some time to think about how the school is operating and how therefore, you know, it could be maneuvered within that framework is, I think, an important thing to consider as a, you know, as a teacher trying to address some of these challenges.
Just on the back of what Sarah said about being critical geographers and being critical in response to our inquiry questions and also the information that we've presented, we also have a role as teachers to represent the students that are in our classroom. So being able to hear and have those discussions and questioning within the classroom and getting students to give their opinion or their experiences doesn't necessarily mean that you need to do extra planning, but you're allowing those voices to be heard within the classroom. When we were talking about LGBTQ plus inclusivity within the classroom, I particularly focused on making really small changes or just dropping it into discussion or giving migration stories about perhaps an LGBTQ plus refugee or somebody is seeking asylum. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to create all of these resources or have a lesson that is completely about this community, because I think that would defy the point of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make it inclusive for all, not just for some. So I think with our slides, you could have representation in, for example, photographs, in stories. You can interweave things into case studies. The RSE guidance as well, specifically with the LGBTQ plus, is that it shouldn't be taught as a standalone subject. It should be interweaved within the curriculum. And so you can make those cross-curricular with PSHE and have those discussions. And again, as you say, maybe set up a working group in your school if there's nobody having those conversations at the moment. But I think my key takeaways would be, if you don't have the the capacity to change the prescribed slides from your school, you can still have these discussions through questioning within the classroom.
And we live in the digital age where there is a wealth of information out there and at your fingertips. So, you know, I've promoted her before. So my friend in the United States, Erin Reed, she's doing massive amounts of documenting on social media about the wave of anti-trans bills in the United States at the moment. And she puts up maps, and it's so terrifying as a trans person with trans friends in the United States. But from a geographer's point of view, it is so rich in the information that it is. So if you're talking about refugees, migration, oppression, you know, prisoners of geography, that kind of thing, then simply looking at her Twitter feed, for example, will provide you with so much information. Or maybe if a student has decided to do it as their NEA or their EPQ or something, you know, then you can direct them to that. Her Twitter handle is Erin in the Morn, if you're interested in that. Now, Alice, now what you said actually kind of lends it quite nicely to something else we could discuss, and that is, what would we each say to, and I don't think this is very common in the geography circles, given the nature of our subject, but I'll ask this question anyway. What would you say to a teacher who might feel that almost exclusively the lived experiences and representation of voice only should come from the demographic that they school represents? So Alice, you were saying that, you know, you've got to represent the cohort, the demographic you've got, and which is correct because it brings context, it makes them feel that they're involved, that they're being seen and stuff like that. But if a teacher only does that and only focuses on, if it's a predominantly white Catholic school, that they only give white Catholic perspectives, what would be your recommendation on that, or maybe even your pushback on that?
I think we have a duty as teachers and educators to give a platform for all voices. And I don't think we'd be good geography teachers if we only focused on one perspective. So whilst you may only be teaching to a certain demographic, you do need to bring those other voices into the classroom. And it's not just the classroom. Students will go out into the world, wider world, where these other people exist. And as geography educators, we need to educate our children and our students on these communities that do exist within and outside of the classroom.
Sarah or Akira?
Yeah, I think to bounce off that, that was kind of our vision with the Voices project. Chantal, my Holloway, and I designed a project and a website and all geographies that spoke about topics that are brought up in the curriculum, like place, space, migration, and kind of leaning that into conversations around empire towards Key Stage 4 and Key Stage 5 in order to kind of equitably put these voices into classrooms where typically they wouldn't be, because you have that like 90% white and potentially, well, a different class mix, but potentially not migrant backgrounds at all. And so when you have voices that represent kind of dominant but minority ethnic groups in the UK that actually have a wealth of knowledge that aren't represented in classrooms, it can be useful to then put those voices into the classroom on purpose, because you know they won't show up. And I think it's as much as, yeah, we think that sometimes our classrooms can do it all, sometimes you have to think practically about, okay, which voices are missing, and actually do that critical analysis yourself of what do I need to bring into the classroom to make this conversation inclusive for all, rather than relying on the diversity of your school to do that work, because often there will be perspectives that are missed out. And then once you include these other voices in the classroom, you get richer conversation, you get questions being asked that weren't asked before, and you get people maybe talking about the nuance of their experience that wouldn't have been brought out unless you had those kind of contrasting voices from different backgrounds actively put in the space. So yeah, definitely would recommend thinking about the resources you might use to fill in the gaps, but to also take time to identify where those gaps are, because that's the start of the work. You have to be a reflexive teacher and also be reflexive with your students about, you know, some of the perspectives that exist in their community that they can see but actually don't ever get brought into the classroom. And some students are quite critical of that. We might assume students aren't, but I think they are.
I think the interesting point about the question is, like, what would you say to a teacher? It's, I think, being a teacher, as we are all very well aware, is a huge position of responsibility, and we are governed by, at the very highest level, you know, the United Nations human rights. And one of those human rights is a right to an education, and that education is intersectional. It has to be. And we have got lots of work to do, you know, but if you're in a position of responsibility, if you have young people in your classroom, then you have to work hard and work harder to ensure that everyone has access to different views, different ideas. And I think it's just a fundamental thing within, especially within the British education system, which is still governed by, you know, UNESCO. And that's fundamentally, therefore, you know, the role of every teacher. So it's really hard, I think. We've got a lot of work to do. But I think it's, you know, every teacher has to have this at the forefront of their mind. You know, so you can feel that question is quite, it makes you quite, I don't know, impassioned about it, and just makes you want to go, no, what would you say? It does, you know, should a teacher be in a classroom if they don't see this as absolutely central? Probably, yeah. Not, would be my opinion, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know if any of the folks that are on the call were in your session, Akira, with Viram, but if you haven't watched that recording yet, or you weren't there, you need to watch that recording, especially when Iram gives her lived experience about, you know, the reaction that she got from the students, you know, where they were stereotyping her and things like that. And she said she could have given out 20 detentions for, you know, but she didn't. She engaged the students, and she did an activity where they talked about her identity and stuff like that. Now, if the kids at the school that Iram taught had that reaction to her as her classroom teacher, look, are you a supply teacher? Are you, you know, what are you doing? Are you, you know, why do people think you lot are terrorists and stuff like that? That is a product of the lack of representation, because those kids don't usually interact with people like Iram. So, and the same was the case in the school in Norfolk that I taught at. Like, it was rural Norfolk. It did have a little bit of Norwich, inner city Norwich, as the catchment area. But our demographic was 98% white, you know? So therefore, as Sarah just said, I felt it was not just a responsibility of me as a geography teacher to open their eyes to the wealth of diversity in the world, but I found it a joy. I found it an absolute joy. It's like, this is all these people, these perspectives we aren't, you don't usually hear from. Isn't this amazing? Did you never thought of it like that, thinking it that way, or the way that they treat the earth, or the way that they manage climate change or flooding or stuff like that? It just blows your mind. And then you take it as a, like a way of inspiring and a way of giving awe, you know, because meeting new people does that. It invigorates you. So I think you're missing out if you don't be diverse and so much in your teaching with representation. Right. That's fantastic. That's really, really good. But yeah, as I say, I do recommend that you look at that. And there is little excuse nowadays, really. Again, if I go back to the digital technologies kind of thing, you know, COVID, for all of its really, you know, the things that came about from that, the nice things came about that, it has accelerated the disruption of technology, where we now have organizations such as, for example, Speakers for Schools, who are free for schools to use. You sign up to it and then you can find someone who's got a certain interest, certain demographics, certain background, certain experience, and get them to beam in virtually and talk to your kids. So, you know, if you want to find, you know, someone who is a volcanologist, or you want to find someone who's a meteorologist, or you want to find someone who works in the rescue agency or disaster management or what, something like that, you can go on to Speakers for Schools and like request someone, and they can beam in and talk to your kids. There is very little excuse to not do that kind of thing anymore. And I'm kind of sad that I'm no longer at the chalk face anymore, because I feel like I've missed out on this opportunity. Because only once did I manage to get one of my best friends from Malawi, Francis Mbakati, to actually beam in to talk to my students. And it only happened once because at the time the technology was pretty pants, you know, and he could only use WhatsApp. So I had to try and project WhatsApp onto the screen and whatnot. But now it's a lot easier. So, you know, and it's so interesting. It's so interesting. Right. So we mentioned about use of textbooks and bits and bobs, stuff like that. And I know, Alice, that you've done quite a bit of work at looking at textbooks and things like that, how representative or not they are. So we'll start with you, Alice, on this one, since you can come right out of the bat with some examples. My question here is, have you come across examples of outdated information or misconceptions embedded in textbook or teaching resources, and how would you approach it, the situation, if you did? So we will start with you, Alex, because I know you've got an example off the top.
I did some research and looked through textbooks. I've also done some further research and analysed geography textbooks. Except with the exception of the geography A-level textbook, there was zero representation of LGBTQ+ communities within those. I also, rather than it being explicitly mentioned within the textbooks, I had a look and looked at maybe cartoons and see if some could be interpreted as perhaps trans, non-binary or homosexual, bisexual people. However, the figures were often confirmed with texts to confirm a cisgender or heteronormative relationship. So in my experience, I found that there's been little representation within textbooks, and textbooks do become outdated. I've also seen a textbook that looks at population pyramids and refers to the male, female as gender, as opposed to sex. I think, as I mentioned before, textbooks can be a good resource and a valuable time saver when planning, but they can be a valuable time saver. However, as I mentioned before, using the questioning and discussion within the classroom, using that critical eye and using PowerPoints and your slides to accompany the textbooks as well is really important. When I looked at an existing scheme of work, just to go off slightly on a tangent, we had these textbooks, and I also looked at an existing scheme of work that perhaps didn't use the textbooks, and I took an existing one and I was able to integrate these LGBTQ+ identities within each lesson, and it took me all of perhaps an hour to do, just to have a look and have a high level plan of the whole scheme of work for Urban World and see how we could integrate these communities within our schemes of work. So comparing families within megacities, we looked at one in two contrasting areas, and the students just had a picture of a same-sex family in one city and then a picture of a nuclear family in another. And the lesson wasn't about LGBTQ+, it was just about different perspectives. And I think it can be really easy to use the textbooks for some of the concept and theory, but then the real lived experience you can accompany with, you can adapt your lessons.
Yeah, I also think that in a situation where there's an error in a textbook or just a complete cultural sensitivity, it's really good to use that as an opportunity to contextualize your textbooks, which you might think is a bit of a weird thing to do. But especially when you're thinking about global worldviews and also like intersectional perspectives, you can think about, OK, where was this textbook written? When was it written? Who was it written by? And how do you know, the loads of different perspectives that exist in the world kind of counter at this. And I think it will give students a better lens on how to critique text as part of a methodology. But also the fact that, you know, the knowledge that is in the classroom is co-created by the teacher, by the people who write the textbooks, and also by them. It makes them feel a bit more of an active participant in creating the knowledge that that they learn. So I think it's really good, especially when it's something that might be, you know, time sensitive, when you're thinking about perhaps a vocabulary that's used to describe different communities and that's wrong. Definitely contextualize that, and don't, for instance, you know, use the word slum when there are many other more modern words that are way more appropriate, and bring that out, like bring that conversation out as something, as a learning point for students and a discussion point.
Anything to add, Sarah?
No, I'm just actually just considering textbooks generally and thinking about the volumes of them that we have, because they're so quickly out of date and therefore you stop using them, and just the volumes and volumes of them. And actually, I really appreciate small individual textbooks for individual topics, because it doesn't feel like such a colossal waste as well. And it's just, it's interesting to look at, because there are virtual textbooks that we've looked at, but they're really difficult to navigate for pupils. And also some people don't have access to the tech to be able to then go on and to use the virtual interface. And so it's just the kind of the value of textbooks. And yes, they're quite helpful, because they give you kind of a point, especially for neurodiverse students. A textbook is kind of like a reference point back again. And if they're used well, they can be beneficial in terms of kind of being able to reflect on what's been learned previously and find a, you know, in its specific exam board based text to be able to go, oh, do you know, today wasn't a good one. I need to go back. I need to review that. And it's there, and it's in the language of the exam board as well. And that's something that, you know, teaching to the exam, I'm very aware that within each of the, I mean, I've taught pretty much all of the different exam boards, and you have to use the language of the textbook, because very often that reflects in the design of the questions, which are then posed in the exam. So you can't kind of go in between different, you know, different texts. So even little things like, I know up further up, there's kind of that concept of development indicators, but that's even at exam board level, where AQA is kind of this HICLIT approach, whereas EdExcel uses developed and developing. And that is the language of the exam. So, you know, I'm in a quandary about textbooks. It's a strange one, because I personally feel them to be really useful, but also I find them really frustratingly outdated. Almost year by year, they're outdated, because things change. You know, year on year, and geography is just one of those subjects that, you know, you find as a teacher that you end up taking the current, the here, the now, and use that as an example, you know. And it, just to kind of think about the recent earthquake and the difference in response on the line of a border. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And that is so powerful. That's so powerful. And so the textbooks kind of get parked, you know. So I think, yeah, it's a quandary. I don't really know, to be honest with you, but I find it frustrating as a teacher to kind of go between these thoughts of, I need one really, because it's just takes so much time, you know, and actually it's a point of reference for pupils who need to review things, but equally frustrating.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's funny you mentioned about, I mean, I would have done exactly the same thing as soon as that Turkey Syria earthquake happened. Boom, straight on it. You know, I think we all did. I mean, you look at the geography teacher Twitter, as I almost immediately boom boom put people, which are, but that's the other thing as well, is that we, you know, we need to act as a community, because we are our own resource as well. So I think the textbooks are exceptionally useful. And, you know, some of the old ones, when it comes to the physical geography, so long as the new theories haven't come out, you know, I was thinking of plate tectonics, you know, when we're now looking at slab, you know, Paul, you know, ridge push and all that kind of stuff. And everyone was like, ah! So, of course, but physical geography doesn't tend to change as much. Mm. So, you know, they're quite, and I like what you said about whole, you know, topic by topic kind of textbooks. So the weather and climate one usually, apart from when they start to talk about climate change, because that's always changing, but, you know, how clouds form usually don't change. So, yeah. And then the other thing about, what about the language? Because if you don't use LIDC, LIC, developing, you know, students are really, you know, they like being activists if they can. I can think of a few students in their exam, they would have actually said something like slum brackets, but an appropriate term would be bracket. I've actually seen them write something like that in an exam. As long as it doesn't eat up their time, I wouldn't say no to do it if they wanted to do that, because I think you've got to make some kind of stand in that way. But I don't know. It's tricky. You're not wrong there, Sarah.
I think that also links to kind of like active kind of political engagement in the classroom, because I remember when I was doing my A-levels, we had like posters saying, you know, Africa is not a country on the walls, and like all of the misconceptions that, you know, students might bring into the work before they've even read anything about a case study. And I think wording and language is something that's been brought up quite a lot in the decolonizing geography circles. And I think it doesn't have to like be this really radical thing. I think we use word maps often in geography, and I think it's just language is a really good opportunity to think about the different geographies of the world and the way perspectives have been created around geography over time, and actually like having the word slum but then in a word map with loads of other different words that have been used in recent geographical, you know, study and textbooks, etc., for students to use and kind of like critically engage with is also a form of geographical learning. And I think giving students the ability to kind of like engage with the different language that's developing and why it's developing is, I don't know, I think that's just really fruitful. And of course, like, we'll always maybe be behind, but I think just knowing that that is, like you said, like in an exam, if a student feels like the wording is wrong, being able to put a bracket and engage with geography on those kind of like micro scales, I think it's great. I think it's amazing. And I think classrooms should definitely engage in those conversations more often than they do, because even to this day, I'm finding out words that I learned about, you know, 5 years ago, actually being based in these histories of, you know, oppression and marginalization. Yeah. And you know, when we use new words, we are doing world building. So I think in teaching students that is the case, you are actually teaching them the skills to think about the world in new ways. And the fact that it's changing every day, like it's the language is changing very, very quickly. That's why these textbooks are out of date.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's what's really, speaking as someone who does mark exams, I think the number of questions where you would drop marks if you didn't use the correct terminology is actually pretty low. So if you were using an alternative word to slum, for example, and the examiner can quite clearly tell what you're talking about and quite clearly, you know that you're appropriately attributing that word to something, then they'll probably still get credited. I'm not going to put my hat on that, because, you know, you could have a very strict team leader, a very strict principal examiner who says, no, you must stick to the mark scheme. But those discussions do go on in meetings of team leaders and principal examiners. And if anybody watching this recording really do want to push the boat and make changes, stuff like that, you know, do consider if, you know, you can approach it as a way of getting a bit of extra income over the summer, right? But do consider taking on a role as an examiner or as a team leader and stuff like that, because then you actually all sort out what's in the mark scheme, how the question is asked. And if so many children have put a certain word rather than slum, it will go on the mark scheme as an acceptable word. So, because the mark scheme is partially developed of what the responses are, so long as the responses are good geography. Little inside knowledge for you there. So change can happen, but we need to empower the students to say if I don't use this word slum, you don't use the word slum, but if the word slum is in the exam, you know, cross it out and in brackets put whatever, that informal we think settlement we should be using instead, informal settlement. Housing and then in your answer, yeah, just use the term informal settlement all the time, because then the examiner is going to say, oh yeah, you know, they're using that in place of that. They're still giving them the mark. You know, it's for me, that shows a good geographer, you know, rather than someone just sticking to me. But anyway, I'm digressing now. You tell I'm quite passionate about that. Right, we've got 15 minutes to go. I want to leave a bit of time for some questions and stuff. So there's two questions I really want to have a go at here. I'm thinking, which is the best one to end on? All right, I'm going to save the other one for the end because I think it's a really lovely one to end with. So let's go with this one. So someone actually in one of the sessions said this statement and then asked for an advice. They said, she said, I feel I have to be very careful as a, and then I've just put in parentheses here for substitution, very careful as a white / able-bodied, neurotypical, cisgender, straight, etc. person to bring in the voices where they are totally absent. Said she's worried about getting it wrong. What advice would you give me? That's a really great, great question. What advice would you give to someone who has all of those privileged traits and doesn't want to get it wrong?
I was going to say doing something is better than doing nothing. I think that as long as you are exploring those voices, engaging with online critical work, and also just trying your best to make your classroom as inclusive as possible. I think having a go and getting it a little bit wrong is better than not having a go at all. As long as you are reflective and keeping up to date with the changes in the language that we use, then that's really important.
I think as a teacher, one of the most powerful things you can do is illustrate that you are also learning, and that there will be, you know, hills and valleys. And I think if you engage with students from the outset and are honest and say, you know, I am learning, and therefore if I get it wrong, if I offend, you know, I'm sorry and I'd love to have that discussion and you must tell me. I think that's a really important aspect, and it sets a really good example actually for pupils as well, because they are able to see what it is like to be a reflective learner. So, you know, and that can be a pretty early stage of, you know, a relationship with a class. You know, even if you've only got them for a year before they all move on or they change groupings, et cetera, et cetera. It's still, I still think it's a pretty powerful thing to do.
So just on the back of what you said there as well, I think even the question was from somebody who was a cisgender, white, straight person. I think as somebody who is part of the LGBTQ plus community, I get things wrong all of the time. But as you said, Sarah, I learn from it, and I learn so much from the students. Like, I've set up a Pride Club every Friday break too. And the conversations that they have and the things they have taught me, I think it's, yeah, it's amazing. And then I can integrate that into my lessons. But you need for the students to see you learning at the same time and taking on board their perspectives as well. Is really important.
Yeah, and I think I would second what Alice said about, like, even whilst being talking about, you know, race and colonialism and the way that overlaps with the curriculum and doesn't show up, I've learned so much about race and colonialism and other marginalized groups that don't come from my background and that could be better included in the curriculum. So I don't necessarily think, of course, you might consider yourself as coming from a place of privilege, but we are all also, you know, people learning, and the fact that you might, you know, start engaging with these conversations more means that you're gonna learn faster than the people who aren't. I think if you sit and do nothing but you're really interested in these topics, you're depriving yourself of opportunities to learn. I actually think that you probably won't learn anything if you don't do anything. And I think I often in multiple spheres, as I'm still a student, you know, I think, I'm not perfect enough at this thing, so I can't write about it. And I've started to realize that actually some of different, like, political geographies that I'm interested in, I just have to head first, like, delve into them to start my journey and understanding them. I can't stand on the sidelines and expect that information to enter me, because a lot of information is experiential and a lot of information requires you getting stuff wrong for you to actually learn it. So yeah, I think you do have to be careful in being patient with yourself and also making sure that you allow your students to give you feedback, like to create that environment where if you say something wrong, you know you'll be held by your students to feed that back to you and teach you where maybe you've said like a phrase that is inappropriate and sensitive, or you've missed out something completely in a lesson that you thought was really inclusive. But I think you have to put yourself in those scenarios to really learn how to, you know, make the best of you know, improving your classroom. And I think that's, yeah, it's a quite an exciting process, very scary, but exciting, I think, for the students alike, to be able to have that relationship with you in the classroom.
But the way you just said that, Akira, like it could be exciting, you know, so you can turn that anxiety in, you know, turn it on its head. And like, and if you're open with your students, you know, and say that and learn with them. And yeah, and you're, both of you are absolutely spot on, you know, what you said. It's like, you know, despite the fact I'm a trans person, I do not have the lived experience of, say, a trans person of color or a trans person who's been made homeless or whatever, or having to flee their state and move somewhere else. I do not have those experiences. So I'm learning all the time as well. And I think the best teachers are also learners as well. I have learned so much as my time as a teacher. And then I'm feeling that I have to work harder now in the role that I do to learn, because I've not been saturated by this amazing pool of experience that our kids all every single day of every, you know, every single hour. One of the things that I really do miss. Right, I'm going to end with this question because I think it's a really lovely one to end with, and probably may you have some specific stories to tell of anybody. So why is it important, or can you give us some examples of the importance of for geography to be accessible? So you embrace, you nurture, and you support the student with 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever protected characteristics or whatever it is, you bring them in, and then geography just makes them flourish. Why is that important? Why do we want these people to flourish, and how can geography be a part of it? Do you have any particular stories, maybe without naming names, about how that's happened, how geography has just made someone flourish? I'd like to start. It's a deep question.
I think if we take out the examined element, because from a neurodiverse perspective, I think at key stage 4, less so funnily enough at key stage 5, because of the field work, but it's still an issue, is that fundamentally when you're examining, and there is a role for exams, I think, but when you're examining on short-term memory and you're examining on literacy. And that is, it harks back to a point in my presentation where I was saying, actually, if you look at what geographers go on to do, so much of it is those skills that aren't examined. It's being able to work as a team. It's being able to inquire. It's being able to problem solve. There is so much more to it. And I do feel that geography as a subject, even though sadly in some ways it is examined on those more frustrating aspects, it allows people to flourish in different ways. And, you know, as I was saying, as that sort of assessment wheel is actually when you get a pupil to reflect on what's going well in the subject, they're not just reflecting on their ability to construct a paragraph. You know, it's the way they are debating, negotiating, analyzing, being critical, interpreting data, using tech, conveying their message. You know, all of the skills that are built into what makes this subject really special. And contextualized within the natural world and society. I mean, it just doesn't, I don't think it gets much better. There is a place for creativity there, you know, it has something for everyone really. And I think that is why when I think about the many classes that I have taught over the years and seeing neurodivergent students just come alive sometimes on a particular, it'll be a particular topic or something, and it just brings out this energy. And, you know, I have my frustrations with assessment, but the subject is extraordinary for that. And where possible and I do highly recommend that everyone goes away and has a look at the Universal Design for Learning framework and explores that in a lot more detail, because I think it gives us as geographers a lot of opportunities to do things a little bit differently and get some fantastic ideas on how to build an intersectional curriculum. Actually, I would go that far. We are restrained by the way we examine, but I do recommend that everyone goes and has a look at that. I'll leave it there because everyone else wants to have a chat.
Sarah, I don't know how I can follow from that answer. That was really, really nice to end with. I think the specific benefits for pupils with these certain characteristics is, I think, yeah, students being able to see themselves be represented in the classroom is really, really powerful. Stonewall have released their report in 2017, where they said that they still hear the word gay being used in a negative way rather than in a positive way, or just in a way to describe somebody. And I think that by having these communities in our everyday conversations can not only improve their geography education, but it can also improve their academic achievement, because they'll, one, be more integrated within to the subject. They have more engagement within the subject because they are being represented. And by not having them in the classroom, you don't know what students that you can lose. So I think the benefits are higher engagement, which can lead to better academic achievement. And it can also create a more integrated community, not only within geography, but within the whole school as well.
Yeah, and I guess to add to that, or so much work has already been said, but it, just thinking about the pipeline to university and later on the types of academic work that's created, but also the work in the wider world that people will do under geography. If you have these identities represented, and also not just represented for the sake of representation, but, you know, making the actual curriculum more accessible, more differentiated for different abilities, more critical around conversations of difference, A, you build the skills for people to build a more accessible and, you know, inclusive world, differentiated, celebratory of difference. But secondly, you then create people who go into, you know, university and create knowledge from their different perspectives, which, you know, is what has been lacking. So it's kind of like this constant kind of like domino effect of, like, if you do these small things in your classroom and students do feel represented, but also students have a better ability to engage with the content of geography will get better. I think all of these things that we're talking about won't be things that we need to talk about if, you know, teachers make these small differences and students can be like, hey, I had that experience and that is being spoken about in a case study, which, you know, happened with the Voices project. So I think, yeah, like these small moments that we notice now and the small projects that we do and the small ways that we adapt our classrooms actually add up to like a better discipline overall. And I think you have to notice what your small thing is that you do actually will have a larger impact, and it's part of a larger movement, just like that that teacher who said, you know, I feel like I need to be careful. Actually, you just taking a step is going to be supported by, you know, thousands of other educators across the country, and you need to see your action as, you know, like one drop in the pond of yeah, all of this great work that's being done.
Yeah. That's one of my favourite analogies, that is the ripple yeah, effect.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I had a flashback to your presentation, Kit. Thank you for that.
Well, We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much, Sarah, Akira and Alice, for a wonderful discussion, a very positive one as well. So often, you know, when people come across the need to enhance EDI and stuff like that, it sometimes can feel like it's a drag, and it doesn't need to be. I mean, celebrating EDI should be joyous, and especially from a geographer's point of view, you know, it's one of the things we absolutely adore about the subject is the vibrancy and diversity of this planet and the people that live on it. So I really do feel that this has been a very informative discussion, a very joyous discussion in places as well. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
The GEO's Geography Quality Marks are prestigious awards which recognise, reward and promote quality and progress in geography leadership, curriculum development and learning and teaching in schools. A powerful process of self-evaluation and reflection, the frameworks incorporate the key messages of the 2019 Education Inspection Framework, supporting schools to develop a curriculum with high quality intent, implementation and impact. As a school working towards the award, you'll receive access to support, guidance and exemplification of quality geography through our webinars and online portal, and assessment and detailed feedback on your submission so that you know where to focus your next steps. You'll also become part of our international network of over 1,500 Geography Quality Mark schools. For further information or to register for the 2023 cohort, please go to our website at geography.org.uk.